Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Understanding and Managing Spasticity. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Philippines Kabahog and Janet Dean, both of whom work for the Kennedy Krieger Institute and the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury. Welcome, and thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Gigi. This is Dr. Kabahog.
This is Janet Dean.
Yeah, and so we are grateful that you invited us to be part of this podcast today. Let me first start the talk by explaining what spasticity is. To bare nuts and bolts definition of spasticity. So whenever you have an insult to your central nervous system, so that could be your brain or your spinal cord, a lot of things can happen, and one of them is that fine-tuning control of your reflexes and your tone. So what spasticity is increased hyperactivity of your muscles and your reflexes that would interfere in your ability to move, to feel comfort. And this is because there is an injury to either your brain or your spinal cord. Normally what happens is that the brain sends signals down through your spinal cord to modulate or to dampen down these hyperreactive reflexes and increased activity. But because of the insult to your central nervous system, this normal modulation has gone basically crazy. It's not working as it should do. When you have spasticity, I'd like to think of it on broad terms. It is just one aspect of what we call an upper motor neuron lesion. So you have spasticity, which means your muscles are contracting crazily, doesn't really relax. That's one. The second part of that spasticity complex is that you have your hyperreactive reflexes. So this is if you've gone to your doctor and then they do the reflex testing and you almost hit them in the face by your knees, that's an example of your hyperreactive reflexes. Another part of that is the clonus. So all of the sudden your muscles are just rhythmically contracting and not stopping, or they would fade down to a stop. That's clonus. Because of the uncontrolled involuntary contractions in your muscles, when you try to move, it's either you can't move or you don't move properly. That could be dystonia, okay? Because of this spasticity, surprisingly, even if your muscles are always contracting, these muscles that are always contracting irregularly could be weak. So this is another side of having spasticity. You're always hyperactive, you're always contracting, but these muscles are weak. You get tired, obviously, because you're always contracting, and doing certain skills, it is more difficult because you lose that control. There are many ways that over time we address this problem of spasticity. One is, I like to put it as like a conservative management versus more aggressive or interventional management. Under conservative, we have physical therapy, exercises, vibration plate, aquatics or pool therapy, and then we also add your medications, which we will discuss later with Janet. Sometimes your physicians can opt to do focal management. Specifically, if there's only one part or one muscle or one joint that is hyperactive, we could do focal spasticity management. And then if the spasticity is very severe and it interferes with your daily functioning, then that's where the talk about undergoing surgery has to happen. Okay. Janet?
So another thing that I wanted to mention is that spasticity isn't all bad, okay? So spasticity can be very severe, or in other people, it's not quite as severe. And so we really don't treat spasticity just to treat spasticity. We treat spasticity when there's things that are happening that interfere with your function. So when you work with your physician, they may ask you, you know, is your spasticity interfering with your activities of daily living? Is it making it really difficult for you to get dressed or take a bath or, you know, sit in your wheelchair comfortably? We may ask you about, is it interfering with your therapy goals? If it's interfering with your therapy goals, certainly we would want to treat your spasticity. We also would want to know, is it keeping you awake at night? If your spasticity is so bad that your legs are jumping, sort of like, you know, some people might have restless leg syndrome, but if your spasticity is so bad and you're jumping at night and it's keeping you awake, then for sure we would want to treat that. And I am a pediatric nurse practitioner, and another area that I'm always concerned about for children is, are those muscles so tight that they're causing deformities? Are they pulling your hips out of the socket? Are you getting scoliosis contractures at your knees? And these are particularly important in children when they're growing, because muscles pulling improperly on bones can cause bony deformities. So those are some questions that we're going to ask you. And if your spasticity is annoying, but it's not really causing you problems with function or staying awake at night, we're going to say, hey, that spasticity is activity, and it's making your muscles work. So it may not need to be treated. Certainly when spasticity is interfering with any of this, then it needs to be treated. Focal modalities like Dr. Kabahu talked about are certainly the first thing that we try. The next thing that we may try if you have generalized spasticity is oral medications. And there are lots of different oral medications that can be used to treat spasticity. And so there's not one perfect medication that works for everybody. So you'll need to work with your neurologist or your physiatrist or your primary care provider to trial different medications. For some people, your spasticity may be managed with one oral medication. But for other people, you may need one or two or a combination of medications. And these medications all need to be trialed, over time. And generally, we start out at a low dose and increase the dose of the medication until we get muscle relaxation or we get side effects. The biggest side effect for most oral medications to treat spasticity is drowsiness. So we are always wanting to start at a low dose and increase slowly because most people can accommodate to the drowsiness and their body gets kind of used to that. And then you'll be able to get the muscle relaxation. But for some people, that's not the case. And we could increase the medication to a point where you have side effects but not very good muscle relaxation. So then we're back to square one of trying another medication or adding in another medication. So finding oral medication that works is trial and error and takes time and takes you to work closely with a physician to help you with that.
So, thank you. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to just go back and just clarify. So aside from medications, as we have mentioned and Janet has also pointed out earlier, there are different modalities that we can try. Together with the medications, you can do certain treatments with your physical therapist or occupational therapist. Mind you, this has to be tailored for each person's individual needs, because not all persons with spasticity present the same or have the same deficits. There are a lot of tools that we use in our toolbox. So we have physical therapy and exercise, weight bearing, and proper stretching programs, especially in those individuals whose tone is so bad that they're developing contractures, we need to maintain as much range as we could. I mentioned earlier the use of whole body vibration. So it's like you're stepping on a plate that basically shakes at a very high frequency that helps dampen that, or that helps inhibit that hyperactivity in your central nervous system. Oh, yeah. And you can do it on a tilt table too, Jan was adding. So what else can we do? We could do dry needling as well, which is done by a certified physical therapist, for example. And aquatic therapy or pool therapy, I find that helps a lot in relaxing a lot of our patients. So that's, if you are in a place that offers aquatic therapy, that would be, as long as you don't have any other issues with skin or wounds, that would be a reasonable option to try. Now, with focal spasticity management, what I'm referring to are the injections that your physician can do, especially if there's like only a few muscles that are hyperactive. And we don't do this lightly. We always work with the patient and with the therapist to figure out and identify what are what I like to call the offending muscles. And it could be anything like in the legs. If your legs are always squeezed up together very tight, then I would focus on the hip adductors. Or, for example, in your calves, or if your feet are always in that tiptoe ballerina position and you can't stand properly or you can't fit into your wheelchair, the plates properly because it's tiptoeing, I would focus on your gastrox. Usually I would inject Botox. Other things that we can inject, and then this depends on what the patient presents, of course, are phenol and ethanol injections.
With children, because of the drowsiness side effect of oral medications, I'm often asking my colleagues to try and manage children with focal injections because, you know, especially kids that are growing and developing and in school, sometimes, you know, kids that have focal spasticity, I would be more inclined to try focal management rather than oral medications in that case, so that we can keep them from being so drowsy in school. So we may look at that before medications, and it may be the opposite for older kids. So then another option for people that have very generalized spasticity, that we've trialed oral medications and don't get the results that we want or have too many side effects, is surgical procedures. Probably the most widely used surgical procedure for people with spasticity is interthecal baclofen pumps, where a pump that can deliver the medication is implanted under the skin in the abdomen, and a small flexible catheter travels around and enters the spine between two vertebrae and goes into the cerebral spinal fluid that surrounds the spinal cord. And in this case, we can put anti-spasticity medication directly into the interthecal fluid that bathes the spinal cord, and we can get generalized muscle relaxation with very low doses of medication, so we don't have the major side effect of drowsiness. An interthecal baclofen pump, generally before the pump is implanted, you do what's called a screening trial, where they use a lumbar puncture and give you a dose of the medication to make sure that your muscles actually do relax to that medicine. And if the muscles do relax, then a pump can be implanted. The great thing about an interthecal baclofen pump is it can be adjusted literally microgram by microgram, so we can fine-tune the dose to just take away that amount of spasticity that is interfering with your function, but then allowing you to function better and have maybe relaxation as well as sometimes pain relief if spasms are causing pain. for some people. A second procedure that somebody asked a question about is called a dorsal rhizotomy. And this procedure is used mostly more in children than I believe adults. And this procedure is a permanent procedure. They take and actually cut some of the sensory nerves that go from your spinal cord into the muscle to interfere with that reflex arc that's causing the spasticity. So this procedure is permanent. So you really need to have a very detailed multidisciplinary evaluation where you're having physical therapists and occupational therapists and neurosurgeons and physiatrists evaluating your child to make sure that you are a good candidate for this procedure. And it's a very small, specific group of children that generally have pretty good strength in their lower extremities, but have spasticity that's interfering with their ability to walk. So this is a good procedure for a very, very specific type of spasticity in children. The good thing about an intrathecal baclofen pump is it's completely reversible. If the pump does not work, it can be removed without any ongoing complications from that.
Okay, great. Thank you both for that overview. Janet, you mentioned that, you know, some people have really severe spasticity and other people don't. Do we know what causes someone to have more severe spasticity than someone else? Is there any?
Incomplete injuries often have more, people with incomplete spinal cord injuries often have more trouble with spasticity because they're getting incomplete signals going through. But that doesn't mean that people with complete injuries can also have a very severe spasticity. Mm-hmm. And there's just kind of no telling who that's going to be and how you're going to respond to the different medications. I think spasticity management comes down to the art of medicine more so than the science. Got it. Some of both, but.
Yep. Okay, and then you did also mention the baclofen pump. So we did get a question specifically about the pump. Can someone be fully ambulatory while they have a baclofen pump, or is it more appropriate for someone who uses a wheelchair?
So the baclofen pump can be used for comfort measures for people that are not ambulatory and are in a wheelchair and really need more relaxation so that it's easier for their activities of daily living and to improve function. But there is a group of patients that, you know, is ambulatory, mm-hmm. and the pump can be very effective. Again, you need a good multidisciplinary evaluation. But because the pump can literally be adjusted microgram by microgram, it is very fine-tunable. Unlike oral medications where you take medications and it depends on how your system processes those, it's very difficult to adjust the dosage. But with the intrathecal baclofen, you can adjust it microgram by microgram, and you can also adjust the doses for different times of the mm-hmm. day. So if your spasticity is really bothersome at night and keeping you awake, we can have a higher dose at night. And then during the day, if you're walking and need some of your tone still to be able to walk, then we can have even a lower dose during the day. So it can be very effective. Now, what I tell my patients is that, you know, it's not a miracle cure for your gait, and your gait may not look different, and you may not, you know, say not need crutches anymore, but you may have less pain from muscle spasms and may have better endurance, and your gait may look somewhat better, but may not necessarily. But most people find the pump to do enough that it's worth having.
Got it. Okay. So now we're going to jump into some more questions. We had one question of this person has had acute disseminated encephalomyelitis since 2014. They've had spasticity ever since. They take CBD capsules to alleviate it, and it works for them very well. And their question is spasticity permanent? And will, you know, they always have these spasms in their lower limbs. And I would just broaden that also to kind of, does spasticity potentially change over time, you know, from when the beginning of when someone's diagnosed to later? So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's more often than not, when you first have the insult to your spinal cord, you end up being flaccid or decreased in tone because you're basically in a state of spinal shock. And then as you recover, and then when the reflexes emerge and then increased tone emerges, and that's when you see the spasticity. I have to put a caveat because it depends on what parts or how involved or how much of your spinal cord is involved. We have patients over time whose spasticity has decreased to a point that they're comfortable and they're functional. There are some patients who over time also have increasing spasticity. And this is where the art of spasticity management is, because we have to identify what are the triggering factors, identify appropriate therapies and management to keep the spasticity under control. Again, it may be there. We may not completely eliminate your spasticity, but through therapeutic interventions, we can help manage them and keep them under control. I guess the big thing is that we have to consider is when you do have your spasticity and it's been stable for a long time, the moment that you have an increase in spasticity, I often ask my patients if they have any ongoing infections, if they're under a lot of stress, because sometimes, like if you have a UTI, it can increase your spasms. If you have an ongoing infection, if you're under stress, the spasms or spasticity can also increase. So these are just things I would tease out when something like this happens.
Thank you. And then we got another question about spasticity being more severe at night. Is this something that you've seen, or does it vary based on the person?
Yeah, so I think Janet and I have answers for that question. It is common that spasticity and spasms are increased at night. And there are a lot of things to consider. One of the most obvious things is if you're busy throughout the day and the moment you lie still or assume a supine position, that's when we notice the spasms and spasticity more compared to the daytime. Another thing also is positioning. Sometimes an abnormal positioning or uncomfortable positioning in bed can trigger your spasms or spasticity. I have some patients who they work so hard during the day that I guess that increased activity carries over at night. So if they exercise too much during the day or more than what they're used to, they notice the increase in spasms at night. How about you, Janet?
Yeah, I think you know, spasticity can be triggered by lots of different things, and people kind of need to learn what different things trigger spasticity. And certainly during the nighttime, it can be worse. And for some people, you can use medications just at night to treat that nighttime spasticity. You don't necessarily have to be on medications all during the day if your spasticity is manageable. And there are some sort of shorter acting medications that you can use at night so that they won't make you drowsy in the morning.
And then we got another question about temperature. So we're talking about, you know, things that might trigger spasticity. This person has a lesion at C4 and 5, and their right arm and leg are affected. They have spasticity in both and manage it with physical therapy exercises. But they found that when the temperature outside is 45 degrees and below, you know, they have really bad spasticity in their arm as well as their leg. And at the other end, you know, when it's hot, you know, above 68 degrees, their arm and hand swell and becomes painful and walking becomes more difficult. Is this an issue that you've seen as well in terms of temperature sensitive spasticity? I mean, I know at the, you know, at the International Center for Spinal Cord Injury, the pool that you have is, you know, quite warm, which I've heard helps with spasticity. But if you could just talk a little bit about temperature and how that might influence spasticity, that would be great.
So as we mentioned earlier, it's important to figure out what triggers your spasticity, and a lot of the times it's the temperature changes. I have patients who can tell when it's going to rain because their spasms are getting worse. So in the grand scheme of things, especially if you have an injury or lesion in your spinal cord that's high up, basically in the neck area or cervical area or the upper thoracic area, we do expect that these people would have problems with temperature regulation, and that could be because of your autonomic dysfunction. Anyone who has an injury in the upper thoracic level and above to the neck, that gets affected because the relay pathway for making sure everything runs smoothly in terms of temperature, blood pressure, heart rate, it goes through that area. So when you have a lesion in that area, I would expect you would have, it's possible for you to have some problems with temperature regulation. Now, in terms of triggering, and I think it makes sense for me that because of where your lesion is, you would have issues with temperature regulation, and that could easily trigger your spasticity. I'm very glad that this person is very aware of what triggers his spasticity in terms of temperature. So that means you can take steps in order to minimize or avoid these triggers. I always like joking that layers are our friends in terms of dressing up, because if it's too hot or too warm or too cold, it's easy. It's an easy remedy. Thank you, Janet and Pat. Yeah.
And then, Janet, earlier you also mentioned how spasticity is not necessarily all bad. Can you talk a little bit about the potential benefits of spasticity, or what kind of those good aspects might be for someone?
Sure. So, you know, spasticity is contraction of your muscle, whether it just is a more involuntary contraction of your muscle. So it's your muscle is actually exercising itself, so it is in some way staying strong. Also, spasticity can make you kind of move around a little bit. So if you have difficulty with changing your position, spasticity, you know, actually makes you, you know, to some extent shift your position when you're sitting. So that can help with decreasing the risk for pressure ulcers. Now, certainly it's not a substitute for pressure relief, but it also can help, like, keep the muscles in your, you know, near your sits, the bones that you sit on, strong, so that you have more padding. And then some people utilize their tone and their spasticity to help them function. So, you know, again, treatment of spasticity and increased muscle tone is a balance for people with spinal cord injury or ADEM or other neurologic conditions, because we need to make sure that we're treating the tone that's causing a loss of function, but not taking away all of your tone that helps keep your muscles active and strong.
Got it. Okay. And then, you know, in terms of, so we've talked about medication and physical therapy. Are there any new physical therapy programs that might help with spasticity, or things that someone can do in physical therapy to help with spasticity?
So aside from your exercise and stretching programs, I mentioned earlier about using whole body vibration to decrease spasticity. There is also the use of dry needling. So basically dry needling is using an acupuncture needle. I am not clear exactly about the physiology of how it does dampen that increased reflex arc, but we have some anecdotal evidence that it does temporarily decrease your spasticity. Mind you, both the whole body vibration and the dry needling, those are not long-term or permanent fixes. They usually don't last that long, probably at most an hour or so. But in here at Kennedy Krieger, we utilize these modalities so that our patients can participate better and do more stuff during their formal therapy sessions. Again, one of my favorites is the aquatics, the pool therapy. As you know, it is very warm. It provides a safe environment to activate your muscles, and it does offer, you know, gentle resistance as well. So you can do a lot of things. It helps with your tone. It supports your body weight. It helps with circulation. It provides resistance to certain movements. So it's very an encompassing therapy.
And then, of course, the functional electrical stimulation cycling that provides electrical stimulation to your muscles and to a kind of repetitive motion in a pattern. I really see that for some patients, again, it can increase spasticity, and for some patients, it can be really nicely decrease spasticity. And for periods of time, and there are lots of different adjustments that you can make to the functional electrical stimulation programs that can help with spasticity. Sometimes we can actually program the FES, whether it's by a bicycle or by a handheld unit, to actually fatigue the spastic muscle. So the therapist will utilize a specific setting on the spastic muscles to fatigue them, so that then during the next part of the session, you can work on strengthening the muscles that are being opposed by those. So there's lots of different ways we can utilize functional electrical stimulation to help treat spasticity. But I do find that particularly patients that I have that have been using the FES cycles from early on after their injury tend to have suppler muscles, that they have spasticity, but you can actually kind of break through it a little bit better. So if you have access to functional electrical stimulation, that can be helpful.
And then we have two questions that are kind of similar. So one is there any specific exercises which help with spasticity in the legs, which occurs when moving from a resting to an active position? Another question is, you know, why do small movements of the legs that are kind of short and quick trigger spasticity more than slower, longer movements? So is there any kind of feature of spasticity as to why that, you know, these kind of smaller or quicker movements or going from a resting to an active position may trigger spasticity?
Let me answer the second question first, the smaller, quicker movements. So if I was going to go nerdy on you, the official definition or the medical definition of spasticity is a velocity-dependent increase in tone. Remember, it's velocity-dependent. The faster you stimulate, the faster the stretch, the stronger the contraction is. So I hope that makes things clearer why the small, quick movements can trigger a lot of spasticity and spasms. Now, with exercises that can help decrease the spasms or spasticity during change in position, I am not clear how to answer that directly unless I really see the patient in action, because there are many things that can trigger the spasticity, and unless I physically examine you and figure out which muscles are specifically being triggered, I am not sure how to advise what we need to stretch or what we need to relax or what the therapist would need to work on in order to help decrease or try to control that. And again, of course, we have to deal with medications and other interventions as well.
And sometimes I think, utilizing focal injections sometimes can, some people have sort of a triple reflex where mm-hmm. once your foot goes, everything goes in your lower extremity. And so sometimes focal injections can be used to break up that yeah. tone pattern. So again, getting a good exam from physiatrist or a neurologist that has lots of different modalities in their bag of tricks can be really helpful.
And then we got a question from someone. So when they're doing physical therapy, they stimulate their scapular retractors and thoracic spine with NMES. And so they're asking, why does this provoke clonus in the biceps during reciprocal leg activities, such as being on a bicycle? And, you know, I've also personally noticed that when my leg spasms, sometimes my fingers on one hand do. So is there any kind of relationship there between different body parts and getting spasticity in one versus another place at the same time?
So I do not have a direct answer to that. We do have a theory regarding that. So if you stimulate your scapular retractors, the rhomboids are served, the nerve serving that those muscles is in the C5 nerve root. Your biceps is C5, C6. So my theory is there must be some overflow and connection in your pattern generators when you stimulate that area. It could possibly overflow to the other muscles that are served by the same nerve root. And also, I'm not really sure how to answer that question because I'm not sure exactly if it's actually clonus or more rhythmic and sustained repetitive movement patterns. Again, it also falls into the theory of perhaps when you use the neuromuscular stimulation, they are stimulating the pattern generations in the upper back cervical area.
Thank you. Yep, sorry, go ahead.
Nope, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. and then I have two questions that are about medications. So I can't remember who mentioned the short-acting medications for spasticity, but someone was asking about what the names of those short-acting medications were because their spasms bother them at night when they lay down and try to sleep.
So the two most common medications that are probably used for spasticity the most are baclofen, mm-hmm. and tizanidine or Xanaflex is the other. Those are both the same drug. And the tizanidine or Xanaflex tends to be a shorter acting medication. So sometimes I've used that at night with my patients. I find that during the day it makes people more sleepy than baclofen, but again, everybody's different. So if somebody's only having spasticity at night and it's just more interfering with them falling asleep, and once they get asleep, they stay asleep, I might use Xanaflex, which will for sure be out of their system by the morning. Mm-hmm. If it's not, if you don't get through the night with that, then you could use baclofen just at night.
And then we got another question about baclofen. So they changed from one generic baclofen, company to another, and they noticed an increase in their spasticity. Have you had any experience with patients reporting that there are differences in the different manufacturers' oral baclofen?
Not specifically with oral baclofen, but with other medications. Some patients are more sensitive to medications as a rule. Now, I've had experience in patients who've shifted from one form or another of a neuron to another medication, and they report there's less effectivity of the new medication that they shifted from the branded medication. I am thinking that perhaps it's just the way that the medication has been manufactured or the binders that are used, because for all medications, the active product, whether branded or generic, it should be the same. Where it differs is what they use to bind or prepare the medications. So perhaps that could be a reason why some people don't respond as well to the different brands of the same generic medication.
Yeah, the only way around that is to write specifically no substitution permitted, mm-hmm. For the brand name, because most pharmacies even don't just only stock one generic. One yeah. time you'll get one time you'll get another.
Right. Okay. And then we got a question about, so this person wants to talk to their doctor about increased spasticity and the possible ways to manage it. And so what info should they be noting about their spasms to help determine the best way to manage? So like, what are things that, you know, they should go to their doctor with to, you know, to be able to tell their doctor, you know, how their spasticity is and how best to manage it?
So, from my point of view, so whenever these are the things that I would wish my patient would tell me more about or elaborate more about. So in terms of spasticity, I'd like information to find out how it was before, what has changed in terms of what is triggering it, are there any changes in the triggers? How has the spasticity interfered with your life? And I ask more specific questions. Does it interfere with your ability to perform your day-to-day activities? For example, is your spasms increased or severe that you can't dress yourself or you can't feed yourself? Or for those who catheterize, they can't catheterize anymore because their legs are shut. I would also ask how much, if there's any concern with pain or any issues with pain as well. I'd like to also find out what medications have they tried in the past, because this is very important. Because as a physician, I am dealing with an insurance company that I have to fight sometimes in regards to why am I choosing one medication over the other. With regards to medication, I would also like to find out if you've tried on a medication in the past, and if you have stopped it, why did you stop it? Were there any side effects, for example? Other things other information that this person can bring to their physician is in terms of how the spasticity has interfered with their life. Is there a certain time of day or activity that the spasticity is worse, because this can help us treat out and plan our management strategy. One thing I also would like to find out, and this is important to me, if you have any other medical comorbidities, particularly liver or kidney problems, because that will dictate what type of medication I can give you or what the dosage will be. Or for some of these oral medications, because they can increase your liver function test. So I need to find out what I should be on top of in terms of monitoring so I can safely give these medications to you. I'd also like to find out what exercises or activities, non-medical activities, have you done in the past or have tried in order to help manage that spasticity. And I think the most important thing is, what are your goals? What do you want to do? What do you want to do, like, when you have the spasticity decreased, what do you want to do? What are your goals for decreasing your spasticity? If it is so that you can drive safely, for example, or if you can transfer without falling out of your wheelchair, or you can safely feed yourself without spilling food all over.
One other thing that I'm going to bring up, and anybody that knows me knows I'm going to bring this up.
Oh, yeah, right. I almost forgot. Yes.
So anybody that knows me knows that I think constipation is the root of all evils in spinal cord injury.
Oh, yeah.
So if somebody's got a lot of spasticity, I'm going to probably x-ray your abdomen to see if you may be constipated. And sometimes treatment of constipation is also one step in helping to manage spasticity, because if that's a chronic problem, it can be triggering off lots of other issues. So that's certainly a path I'm going to go down, and I know my colleagues also go down that path too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned from Janet a long time ago, the poop is the root of all evil.
thank you. And then I also, so just personally too, I have spasticity that whenever I would go see my doctor, it would never happen. So he told me to take a video of the spasticity, because it usually happens when I'm like going down the street or something. So that was also a helpful suggestion, since I couldn't replicate it in his office. So just wanted to throw that out there as well. So that's actually, we're at the end of our time on this podcast. I wanted to thank you both very much for joining us. This is the first podcast on specifically on spasticity. So we hope to continue the conversation at a later date as well. But thank you both very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting us. Have a good day, everyone.
Have a good day. All right. Thank you. Bye.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.